From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dennis Hopper is best known for his films like Easy Rider, Apocalypse Now, and Blue Velvet. But he's also a photographer and art collector. His photos from the 60s are now on exhibit in Los Angeles. On this archive edition, we'll feature an interview with him about how the visual arts connects to his work as an actor. Also, we'll talk with actress Mary Warrenoff about the 60s when she was part of Andy Warhol's factory and danced and toured with the Velvet Underground. Her memoir about those days has just been published in paperback, and she has a new novel. And John Powers reviews Gone in 60 Seconds, the new action film starring Nicolas Cage and Angelina Jolie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton says he won't hesitate to veto a House bill repealing the federal estate tax. The president said the measure represents a windfall for the rich. The measure passed today after more than 60 Democrats voted with Republicans, approving the bill by a margin big enough to override a presidential veto. Supporters say the measure is designed to protect the heirs of small businesses and family farms. The U.S. and North Korea have agreed to resume a joint effort to locate and recover the remains of American servicemen still missing from the Korean War. NPR's Ann Bozell reports.
The Pentagon estimates 8,174 servicemen are unaccounted for from the war. This agreement allows the U.S. to conduct 5 missions to look for their remains in 2 counties about 60 miles north of Pyongyang. The area is the site of several major battles, and the Pentagon believes more than 500 sets of remains may be uncovered there. The agreement permits searches all the way to the Chinese border, where many hundreds of American POWs died in camps. The U.S. will be allowed 20 people on each search team, and each mission will last 25 days. The lead U.S. negotiator says the U.S. will pay North Korea about $400,000 for each of the 5 searches. The first one will begin on June 25th, the 50th anniversary of the start of the war. Ann Bozell, NPR News, Washington.
A federal appeals court in San Francisco has overturned a lower court ruling that allowed Macaw Indians in Washington state to hunt gray whales. The panel said the federal government failed to consider the impact of hunting on the gray whales, which were taken off the endangered species list in 1994. Environmental groups opposed the hunting, and some protesters attempted to disrupt the hunt. 2 of the 5 major record labels announced today that they've settled a copyright infringement suit against the popular internet music site MP3.com. NPR's Rick Carr reports from New York.
The major labels filed suit in January against MP3.com over services that allow users to catalog their CD collections through the internet company's website, then access that music through any computer with an internet connection. MP3.com blocked major label music from the services in May after a U.S. district court judge ruled in the label's favor. The settlements mean that the works of artists with the Warner Music Group and BMG Entertainment will once again be available. None of the parties disclosed the terms of the deal, but industry sources speculate settlements with all 5 major labels will ultimately cost MP3.com close to $100 million in royalties. Right now, access to the website is free, but analysts say the presence of major label music will make it easier for the company to start charging subscription fees. Rick Carr, NPR News, New York.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 55 points to close at 10,614. This is NPR News. Civil rights leader Jesse Jackson and members of the King family are criticizing the findings of an 18-month Justice Department investigation into the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. The investigation said it found no credible evidence that anyone but James Earl Ray was involved in the murder. Martin Luther King III said he doesn't believe the government is capable of investigating itself on such a sensitive matter. Jackson said he doesn't believe that Ray had the resources to carry out the assassination without help. More than 50 representatives from top U.S. companies are in Havana for a U.S.-Cuba business summit. Tom Gibb reports.
The summit is an annual event, but it's raised particular interest this year because of a proposal before the U.S. Congress to exclude food and medicines from the U.S. economic embargo against Cuba. If this passes, there'll certainly be no shortage of U.S. companies trying to do business with the communist island. The past few months has seen a steady stream of representatives from many of the largest U.S. food and medical companies visiting Cuba. The names at today's summit include the Pepsi-Cola Bottling Company and the makers of Wrigley's Chewing Gum. Present embargo regulations make any trade with Cuba in practice very difficult. Congress may vote this month, although supporters of the embargo hope to block the measure through procedural maneuvers. For NPR News, I'm Tom Gibb in Havana.
Painter Jacob Lawrence died today at his home in Seattle. He was 82. Lawrence was best known for his series of paintings that depicted the black experience, such as Migration, a 60-painting series showing the movement of black Americans to new lives in the North. This is NPR News.
Support for National Public Radio comes from SmartMoney.com, financial advice, analytical tools, and coverage of the financial world, on the web at SmartMoney.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Actor and director Dennis Hopper is best known for such films as Easy Rider, Apocalypse Now, and Blue Velvet. He's also an artist, photographer, and art collector. An exhibit of his photographs from the 1960s is on view through mid-September at the Max Center for Art and Architecture in Los Angeles. On this archive edition, we have a 1996 interview with Hopper in which we talked about his involvement with the visual arts and how that relates to making movies. We talked first about growing up in a small town in Kansas.
I just remember it was a dry state, but if you're old enough to get your hand up on a bar, they'd put a drink in it. So,
you know,
and fighting around the drive-ins seemed to be, and not the drive-in movies, but the drive-in hamburger joints seemed to be the big thing to do after football games. And my mother managed a swimming pool in Dodge City, Kansas, so I had an active swimming life as a child. And my grandfather's a wheat farmer. So it was a good life.
Was it fun to see movies about Dodge City living there?
Well, I remember Errol Flynn came to Dodge City when I was about 5 years old. That was a big time for the premiere of, I think it was called Dodge City. I think for Fort Dodge or whatever it was. It was a movie that Errol Flynn starred in with Olivia de Havilland. And anyway, they came there. That probably had a lot to do with me eventually wanting to be an actor, I think.
Was that the only connection you saw between the movie world and your own life?
Well, I mean, I was raised at the end of the Dust Bowl, so I used to tell people the first light that I really saw was not from the sun, but it was from a movie projector. You know, my grandmother used to, she didn't drive a car, so she used to fill her apron. We lived about 5 miles outside of Dodge, and so my grandfather would go off to the farm in Garden City, which is 60 miles away. My grandmother would fill her eggs full of apron on Saturday mornings.
Fill her apron full of eggs?
Yeah, and we'd walk into town. She'd sell the eggs at the poultry place and get the money. We'd go to see a matinee. And I'd see the Singing Cowboys. Once in a while, we'd see an Errol Flynn movie or a sword-buckling movie. That's about it. I don't really remember what they were, but I knew I wanted to know where they were making these movies. And Kansas was a very flat place, so I wanted to know where the trains were going and, what a mountain looked like, what a skyscraper looked like, what the ocean looked like. And years later, I thought that I think it's one of the reasons I became so interested in the visual aspects of things, because that horizon line, when I finally saw the ocean when I was 13 years old, I saw my first mountain when I came to Colorado when I was 13 on the way to California. I was really disappointed. My mountains that I'd imagined were so much bigger. And I got to California and I saw the ocean. It was the same horizon line that I'd seen on the wheat field. And I thought, wow, this is not what I'd imagined, you know. I don't know what I thought. I thought you could see all the way to China or something, or look different. It'd be a different angle. But it was the same horizon line. And I think that then I saw my first skyscraper, not as big as I'd imagined. I always thought that, like, my imagination had been developed quite was a little out of whack, you know. My buildings were bigger, my mountains were bigger, and the ocean was bigger in my imagination than in reality. So,
well, when you started taking photographs, did you want the size of buildings and the size of mountains to be as big as they had been in your memory from movies, or did you want them to be as real as reality was, even though that was often disappointing?
Yeah, well, you know, what I did was I I became an actor when I was 18 years. I started acting at the Old Globe Theater in San Diego when I was 13, and doing Shakespeare and doing all that. So when I was 18 years old, I moved from I moved from San Diego to Los Angeles, and in a short amount of time, I got a contract at Warner Brothers. I was still 18 years old. I just graduated from high school, and I was now under contract to Warner Brothers, and I was doing Rebel Without a Cause. And when I was 19, I did Giant with Rock Hudson, Elizabeth Taylor, and James Dean. So during that period of time, everybody was photographing me. So when I started taking photographs, which was in this period of time, I'd already been a painter. And I started taking photographs, not of people, but of walls and of things where I had no depth of field. I would shoot flat on, so I had a painting surface. So I'd shoot flat on a wall or flat on something, and it would become like the surface of a painting. So that was my early beginnings of photography in the early 50s. And then I went through a Cartier-Bresson decisive moment period when I came to study with Lee Strasberg in New York, which is where you catch something in action. Guy's throwing a ball, it's just before he catches the ball, or somebody's walking over a puddle, which is a famous thing. He's got his foot up just before his foot hits the water, or whatever. It's a moment where you see with a still camera when to push the shutter.
What were a couple of the decisive moments that you clicked the shutter for?
Oh, dear. Well, I mean, through the time of my career of taking photographs, I was a lot of different places. I was at the free speech movement in Berkeley. I was at the hippie love-ins. I marched with Martin Luther King through the South. I was a student. I was in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I was at the March on Washington and Selma to Montgomery and all those things. So I covered, in that decisive moment period, I covered everything from attack dogs and, you know, biting us to a flower being handed to Martin Luther King, you know, by a young girl.
Now, what was your first exposure to art? Was there any art around when you were growing up? And I'd even be interested in hearing if your parents or grandparents had, you know, tacky, kitschy things that they decorated the house with.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I drew when I was a kid, and I studied at the Nelson Art Gallery on weekends. They had an underprivileged children's art class.
Were you an underprivileged child?
Well, I got in there. Yeah, I was. I slipped in. So at that time, I was in a drawing class, and I was doing a little watercolor like I'd learned in Dodge City. And this man came up to me, and he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm painting this rock and river and so on. And he said, well, son, he said, I don't know how to tell you this, but someday you're going to have to get tight and paint loose. Yeah. And this man was, I'm trying to think of his name, kind of just slipped his name right out. But he was Jackson Pollock's teacher. He was, this is going to drive me crazy. Thomas Hart Benton. Thomas Hart Benton, yeah. He taught me, taught Pollock. Anyway, I studied there, and I found that I would go into the theater and draw the actors.
The movie theater or stage theater?
Stage theater, mm-hmm. Where they were rehearsing plays, and I'd sketch the actors and. So that was sort of my beginning of my art career. And when I arrived in Los Angeles, I had worked at La Jolla Playhouse, and my friend who was my boss there, he was an interior designer, and he was working with Mary Price, Vincent Price's wife, who was an interior designer. They had a kiln where they did tile work at Vincent's house, and I went up there and made some tiles. And that's where I saw, Vincent was an art collector, and that's where I saw my first friends, Klein, my first Jackson Pollocks, my first de Koonings, and so on. We're at his house, and I'd been painting abstractly, but I'd never really thought that anybody really painted abstractly until I saw these things.
Now, it must have been interesting to be exposed to your first abstract art through somebody's private collection as opposed to through a museum.
Yeah.
Did that, in a way, encourage you to later become a collector? I mean, because it was part of how you were first exposed to it. I know you collect a lot of art.
Yeah. Well, Vincent gave me a painting, actually, when I was about, I was 19 or 20. Vincent gave me a small painting. I don't even remember who it was by now. Mm-hmm. And I said, I know that that you're probably going to be a collector, so let me start you off.
Gee, how nice.
And then when I got my first money, I did start collecting art. And, it's like a compulsion. I was thinking about it the other day. I think that, you know, I don't have a formula where I go to the right dealer and buy the right painting. I've been very fortunate to seem to have an eye. I bought Andy Warhol's for a soup can painting, hand painted for $70. But...
when was it? Is it?
It was like 1963, I believe.
Why did you want it? What spoke to you about the painting? What did it?
The first time America had an art form of its own was abstract expressionism. We'd always imitated the Europeans before that. And rather than drawing a mountain and saying, I'm now going to draw a mountain, or I'm going to draw a tree, or I'm going to draw this wonderful face of this person, abstract expressionist says, we're going to use paint as paint. We're not going to draw anything. We're going to make a brush stroke, and that's going to be the painting. And it's going to be action. It's going to be done with action. So we're not going to have time to think and preconceive a lot of stuff. We're just going to use our motion and use the action of painting itself and make that become the design and the pattern and the motion of the canvas. And so this changed the whole way that everybody looked at art. Now, at that time, there was a group of painters in San Francisco called the Bay Area Figurative Painters, and there was David Parks and Elmer Bischoff and Richard Diebenkorn and Nathan Oliveira, whatever. And they were using abstract expressionist terms, and they were going back and using the figure. And I looked at this, and I said, no, this is good painting, but this has already been done. So Tina had done this before in France, before abstract expressionism. This couldn't be the return to reality, because they're using old forms to return to reality. It doesn't make sense to me. So when I saw my first soup can painting, and I saw my first by Andy Warhol, and I saw my first cartoon paintings by Roy Lichtenstein, and I saw the billboard paintings of Rosenquist, and I saw Oldenburg's giant hamburgers and so on, I realized that this was the return to reality, that this was the comic book and the soup can and the Coca-Cola bottle of Jasper Johns and so on, Rauschenberg, and these guys were coming back to reality with a whole new set of things. I mean, before pop art, as we know it, popular art, commercial art, came into being, the largest lithograph was just a 2-foot by 3-foot piece of paper. Then suddenly we could use, there was Rosenquist, and suddenly we could do what commercial art could do. We can make lithographs the size of billboards, and Ed Keenhall showed us that we could take things off the wall and we could make rooms and environment, and Rosenquist took the square and the rectangle and broke the surface for the first time in 1961, and suddenly we had different shaped canvases, and suddenly there was hard edge, and it went on and on, and it was a wonderful, wonderful life I've had in art, because I've seen so many different things happen and develop.
My guest is Dennis Hopper. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. On this archive edition, we're listening to a 1996 interview with Dennis Hopper. There's an exhibit of his photos from the 60s in Los Angeles. Early in Hopper's acting career, he was doing TV, but also living another life helping Andy Warhol make his first films.
I did his first film with him called Tarzan and Jane Revisited, which he shot out in Los Angeles. Andy had his first shows in Los Angeles, and Roy Lichtenstein. They didn't have them in New York. They were shown at the Ferris Gallery in Los Angeles.
Huh.
And a lot of this was because Marcel Duchamp had the only retrospective he had in his life was in California in 1963 at the Pasadena Museum. A friend of mine, Walter Hopps, gave him a retrospective there. So it brought all the artists out from New York and around the world to Los Angeles suddenly.
No, no, Marcel Duchamp. I mean, did you read his diaries, his journals?
No, no, I never did, but I knew him.
You knew Marcel Duchamp?
Yeah.
How'd you meet him?
Well, I met him at his retrospective.
At the retrospective?
Yeah, all of us sort of did.
You didn't play chess with him, did you?
Actually, I did.
You
yeah,
did?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not for very long.
So
he was really good.
What was it like to play chess with Marcel Duchamp? I mean, there's like, John Cage has talked about that too, about how he loved to play chess with Duchamp. That was a big thing for Duchamp.
Well, I sat down at a table with him for about 3 minutes. It was a thrill, okay?
Right,
but
right,
I don't
right.
know what moves I made or what he
right,
did, you know, except right. that I was thrilled by it. And that was the same day he was playing. There's a famous photograph of him sitting with playing chess with a nude, and that was in Pasadena.
Now, Dennis Hopper, can I talk with you about music a little bit? Has music
sure.
played an important part in your life? Do you like music a lot? Listen a lot?
Oh yeah, yeah.
You grew up in your early years before rock and roll. What did you listen to before rock and roll?
Marie, the dawn is breaking. Marie, my heart is aching. You know, something like that.
So this is the era of the Four Freshmen. Who am I thinking of? The Four Aces. The Four Aces.
Right, exactly.
Harry Como, Patti Page. Could you tell
God,
the good from
right.
the bad then? I mean, was there a difference to you between, say, you know, Patti Page and Ella Fitzgerald?
It's a big, wide, wonderful world. Really? Yeah. No, I could. I didn't know. Listen, I was having enough problems just trying to get through high school.
was there anything you loved out of all that period of pre-rock and roll pop?
Well, I was a big when I got to Los Angeles when I was 18. This is like 1954. I got into jazz right away.
Uh huh.
So there was a period of there before rock and roll. I'm not sure of the years, but there was a period of time there where jazz was king, and Miles Davis was the greatest act in the country, and. Bob Rafelson said to me once, who was the curator, the creator of the Monkees, and later went on to do 5 Easy Pieces with Jack Nicholson and so on, and make some wonderful films. But at the time, he said, if Miles Davis hadn't turned his back on the audience, the Beatles would never have been able to invade this country so easily. But Miles would only blow at a certain point when he felt like it. And so he would go out and just stand there and not maybe go through a whole concert. I've seen him go through whole concerts where he didn't blow at all and did make some fans angry. But I still love jazz. And rock and roll was something that I listened to secretly on the radio. I had a channel. I would move it to the rock and roll station. But even my wife, when she got in, I would change it to classical or change it to popular or change it to something. I didn't want anybody to know that I was listening to rock and roll. Man.
Why
it was
not?
Like animal music. You're not supposed to be listening to it. And this was a condition that went on for some time. And by one time my wife got in the car and started the car before I changed the station. It was playing rock and roll. I said, oh, I love rock and roll. I said, you do? Yeah. Big surprise, huh? Oh, wow.
You might be one of the few adults who had to hide rock and roll.
Yeah, well, it was strange, you know. It was a strange time. It's like, it's easy to accept pop art, and it's easy to accept abstract expressionist art most places these days. But in the old days, if you had an abstract painting, that was really weird. And if you had a soup can or a cartoon hanging in your house, I mean, who were you? What kind of weird person were you? And listening to rock and roll was like listening to the jungle or something. It just was unheard of. I mean, it was not accepted.
Now television, as we mentioned, you were doing a lot of episodic television in the, late 50s,
mm-hmm.
early
mm-hmm.
60s.
Yeah.
When did television come into your life? Not as an actor, but as a viewer.
Oh, as a viewer. I saw my first television show when I was 13.
That's pretty old.
Same year as I saw The Mountains. Yeah, well, I was like, I was, how old was I? What year would it have been? 40.
Right.
It'd be about 1949, something
yeah.
like that.
What about the best shows to do when you were acting in episodic television? I saw you in the pilot of The Rifleman. You know, they were rerunning it on the Family Channel.
Wow.
It's a really great series. And the episode you're in, you're like the kind of kid gunslinger who comes into town. And
you know,
you're a real show-off in it.
Sam Peckinpah wrote the pilot for...
Yeah, well, he wrote and directed a lot of them. Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't direct it, but he wrote it. But he was there on the set telling me how to play the part. So, but Sam and I had known each other for years.
Huh.
He was the only guy I knew that smoked grass besides me.
Huh.
So we could hide together and on the studio lots and smoke a joint every once in a while.
Just one question about marijuana and other drugs. Do you think that they affected your visual sensibility at all, or you know, your artistic interests?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm in these 12-step programs because I had a problem. You know, I became a drug addict and mm-hmm. alcoholic. So I'm sort of torn with this question. I think that I don't think anyone needs them
mm-hmm.
to enhance their visual or intellectual capacities. Does it help? It might in the beginning open up some doors, you know, but those doors rapidly close if you're a drug addict, and it's not a way of seeing, it's a way of dying, and that's a reality. As far as drinking, I mean, being an alcoholic and a drug addict, it was so easy for me to point to, because I'm an artist, after all, it's okay for me to drink and take drugs because I have an excuse, and being in total denial about the fact that you're an alcoholic and drug addict, because after all, Van Gogh spent a whole summer of drinking to find that yellow. And then at the end of it, I say, well, yeah, he probably couldn't find the tube the yellow was in. He was so drunk. Yeah, but you justify all these things, and it's too easy to justify using drugs and drinking because you're an artist. And I can't cop to that excuse. I can say, yes, in the beginning, everything works. Sex works, drugs works, everything works. If you go too far with it, it becomes less effective, and then you start working for it rather than it working for you.
Right.
And some of the greatest artists of all time never drank and never took drugs, and that's a reality as much as it is a reality that there, a lot of them did, and a lot of them died painfully stupid lives, which they could have been avoided if they hadn't drank and taken drugs.
Yeah. I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, it's always a pleasure. It's great listening to your show.
Dennis Hopper recorded in 1996. His photographs from the 60s are on exhibit through mid-September at the Mack Center for Art and Architecture in Los Angeles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Additional support from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD, on the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide at www.alcatel.com. And from Random House, Inc., Crown Division, publishers of The Forest, the novel by Edward Rutherford, author of London, and Sarum. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Shiny, shiny, shiny boots of leather.
Mary Warrenov used to do the whip dance when the Velvet Underground performed this song in concert. Coming up, we talk with her about touring with the Velvets and working in Andy Warhol's factory. And film critic John Powers reviews Gone in 60 Seconds. Time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Actress Mary Woronoff dropped out of college in the mid-60s to dance and tour with the Velvet Underground and appear in the Andy Warhol movie Chelsea Girls. Woronoff went on to act in several Roger Corman films, including Death Race 2000 and Hollywood Boulevard. She also co-starred in the film satires Rock and Roll High School, Eating Raoul, and scenes from the class struggle in Beverly Hills. Her memoir, Swimming Underground, My Years in the Warhol Factory, has just been published in paperback. It coincides with the publication of her first novel, Snake. On this archive edition, we have an interview recorded in 1995 after her memoir was first published. Woronoff grew up in a fairly conventional 1950s home. She went to private school. Her mother was a homemaker, her father a doctor. She says it was an Ozzie and Harriet kind of life and describes her childhood as happy but unhappy. Everything changed when she went to Cornell University. She met people who were into sex and drugs, and she met Gerard Malanga, who introduced her to Warhol. She and Malanga danced with the Velvet Underground as part of the Warhol show, The Exploding Plastic Inevitable. I asked her about her entrance into that world.
Well, actually, what happened is, the first thing that happened is I did a movie. And then I thought, well, this is fine. I have a job. You know, I'm going to do these movies for Warhol, for which I'm not paid. What a great job. I was very naive. What happened is the Barbara Rubin brought the Velvets in, and they would play, and... You know, Gerard was not one to give up a stage, so he would get up on the stage and start dancing, and I was with him, so I would get up on the stage and start dancing too. And it just became this, like, show. They put a movie in back of the Velvets, and we danced in front, and the Velvets played, and then Andy started moving it around as the Exploding Plastic Inevitable, and we went to California. But I danced in front of them all the time. It was great.
I want you to describe the dances that you and Malanga did to the Velvets.
That's going to sound very strange, but, well, first of all, both of us are dressed in black leather by now, and both of us have, you know, whips. But it was definitely rock and roll dancing. It wasn't, Martha Graham-ish at all. It was rock and roll, but we would have all these different things like black lights and those flickering strobe lights and crosses, and we would dance with these objects. Everybody there was very accustomed to happenings, as they were called then. You call them performances now. But doing things while you were dancing was nothing. I mean, it was considered fine. And Gerard and I were just very good together. We were very instinctive. So, you know, you dance, both of you have a whip, you know, you do all of these sort of, you know, pretend S&M things while you're dancing.
Like what?
He spent a lot of time on his knees, and he kissed, you know, kissed the whip. Because, you know, in one of the songs it says, kiss the whip lightly. He would do that. It was actually very sexy what we did.
That song also says something about licking your shiny boots. Did he lick your boots, too?
A lot of kissing of boots and licking of boots. As a matter of fact, he made a whole movie of it. I didn't get to talk in that movie, obviously, but... look, we were very young, and we just did things, you know? And nobody said no.
Most of the people in the Warhol crowd had a persona, you know, often a pose of some sort, or a transformed person who they became. Did you have a pose, a persona?
Yes.
What was it?
My pose at the time was unsexual, gender shifting into male, very powerful, very threatening.
Now, you describe yourself as asexual in your persona, yet the whip dance that you did was very much about sexual turn-on. So make those two add up for me.
I believe that, especially during Warhol, one of the sexiest things about that whole time was gender slipping. I do not think that it's unsexy. I think it's very sexy. A girl... Well, first of all, I mean, the entire basis of Warhol's movies in the beginning was all of the drag queens, and they certainly were gender slippage, and they were certainly very, very sexy. Um, a lot of art is about, you know, gender slippage, and that's what makes it sexy. That's what makes it interesting and attractive.
But you described yourself as having an asexual pose, and yet...
I did not come on flirty, you know, and want a lot of guys. I would pretend that I was a man. Not pretend that I was a man. I would act very masculine. And to see such pretty girl act very masculine was a turn-on. I mean, all I did was act, you know, sort of tough.
And you're about 6 feet tall, so you were imposing also.
Yes. Everybody posed. If you didn't pose, nobody saw you. It was a fight to get the biggest pose on. And that's what we liked, posing. I mean, you can't be around all of those queens and not think about posing every minute of the day. It was a language.
Was it tiring after a while to live in a pose? Or did you become that person?
Nothing was tiring. We were all on amphetamine. There wasn't tired.
But was it mentally exhausting to have to stay in pose all the time? Or did you become the person?
No, you never become the person. I mean, the whole thing about our poses were they were completely ridiculous. I mean, first of all, half of those guys, you know, when they got dressed up as girls, they didn't do it like guys do it now. It was you know, totally dumb. They'd have runs in their stockings and, you know, runs in their hair. And it was about doing something that was not, obviously not working, but pretending it is working to such an extent that everybody buys it. It was fun.
I think the thing that I found alarming reading your memoir was the time when you and a lot of the Warhol people were, I guess it was a party or a gathering of some sort, and one of the women there OD'd.
Yes.
And someone stretched her out on the table, and the party kind of continued.
Yes.
She was kind of like the centerpiece at the table.
We were so far gone that death didn't really enter in as this is a person and her life is gone. We weren't even thinking of her as a person.
She actually lived. She hadn't really died.
No, she hadn't. She hadn't. I didn't have that much experience with heroin, and apparently you look like you can go under and then you come back. And I didn't even know she was shot with heroin. So, we all thought she was dead.
At what point did you say to yourself, it is not human to behave this way? You know, that something's terribly wrong.
Yeah. When I stopped taking drugs.
I mean, were you shocked when you looked back on that?
No, because I can remember how I felt. It was fine. And I didn't really get in trouble. I mean, you know, a lot of people get in trouble with drugs and they see people, you know, shot in the head and killed. And I was very, very protected.
Right.
But this was, the reason why this is in the book is because this was like, a slight error. You know, and I understand it was just really horrible, and thank God she did live, but it was like, a slight error. I mean, you know.
That's how far gone you all were.
Yeah. Yeah, we were really crazed on that one.
My guest is Mary Warrenoff. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. On this archive edition, we're listening to an interview with actress and writer Mary Warrenoff. She has a new novel, and her memoir about her Warhol years has just been published in paperback. I don't know if you saw this or not, but Victor Boucris, while writing about the life and death of Andy Warhol, quoted Gerard Malanga as saying, "Mary was someone I invented. I got a whip in her hand, spread her name around, made her a star, but she did not show any interest, and because of her passiveness, allowed herself to be eclipsed by Ingrid's superstar." What do you make of that?
Gerard is right. He definitely invented me. He found me at Cornell, and when he brought me to New York, I was definitely someone different. But I wanted that invention. I really loved that whole scene. I mean, he would suggest something, and I would go, yes. The reason why he says that I was passive in Eclipse is I was not interested in becoming a superstar. I was not interested in fighting for Edie Sedgwick's place. Fine, I would do a movie, but I was not interested in becoming a star. They loved girls to fight and, you know, to try and be stars, and I just would not take that place. If Ingrid wanted to pretend she was a star, fine, go let her. I refused to go into that game, and Gerard was furious with me because, rightfully so, I was the most talented. I was the one who, you know, understood what should be happening. Even Andy said this to me. But I just, you know, I didn't feel like fighting. I like the Queens. I like the whole drug scene. I just wanted to do what I wanted to do. I didn't, you know, if Andy sat down and then four girls tried to sit next to him, I'd walk the other way.
Now, you write in your book that this was a period when you didn't like sex.
No, I hated it.
I'm trying to figure out if I can ask you to explain why on the radio. What do you think?
Well, for one thing, my parents didn't get along the way I thought someone should get along, so I definitely was against marriage. I was also, at the time, very young, and I was furious at the thought that I should be happy just being a wife with a man. That really infuriated me. I had floating rage about that one. The other thing is that I went to Cornell after being, you know, a virgin for a very long time. I did not have a great experience. I mean, you know, this apparently very nice kid, tried to go with me. And I was just so mad and so angry that it didn't work out. And instead of being upset, I said, okay, we're just going to make rules. And one of the rules is that, you know, sex just isn't in the game for me, and I just don't want it. And, you know, these other girls can, you know, go make fools of themselves, but for me, it's out. And I would do that, and then I would say, this is the way I'm going to lead my life. And until I met a giant stone wall, that's the way I did lead my life. I would always make up rules and say, this is the way it's going to be, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to be different than everybody else.
I do find it really interesting that during this period when you were defiant about not having sex, that you were doing this very provocative whip dance, turning yourself on and everybody else.
No, I think it's really normal because you can't shut someone down when they're starting to peak with their hormones. I mean, I had to do something.
So it all came out in the dance.
Yes, it all came out in everything I did, everything I touched. I mean, I was a walking joke. You can't just shut someone. I was a, you know, a fool, a young fool.
Now, you were in Warhol's film Chelsea Girls. Why don't you describe your role in that?
My role in Chelsea Girls was, first of all, the name was Hanoi Hannah, and it was taken from this woman who had a radio show during the war, and she would taunt the American GIs. But rather than being sexy about it, I think I was just basically brutal. Brutal beyond what a normal girl should be capable of, also intelligent, so that I sort of knew what was going on. And what Warhol would do is he would put a lot of people, you know, in front of a camera and then hope that something would happen. I knew what he sort of wanted to happen, and I would engineer it. And then, you know, people would fall into place. You know, if you had one strong person, you needed a victim. And so the victim would usually be found. And then, you know, you do what you can.
Your mother sued Andy Warhol after Chelsea Girls. Why? Because he didn't pay you? Was that it?
No, he didn't pay anybody. He was like Corman. He was the cheapest man in the world. My mother thought that... My mother always stood behind me. She said I was doing something artistic. I went to Cornell to be an artist. Now I was with Warhol. It did not matter to her that, you know, I was running around in skin-tight leather, paraphernalia, and drugged out of my mind. It was artistic. So she let me do all of these things. But the minute that I stopped showing interest, she suggested to me that I should get paid. And then Morrissey came to me and he said he wanted me to sign something.
This is Paul Morrissey, who made some of the films.
Yes. He said he wanted me to sign a release for Chelsea Girls. And I told my mother, she'd always told me never to sign anything because she was afraid I was going to sign something communist, you know. So I told my mom and she said, no, 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 don't sign that and let me sue him. And I just, you know, I said, okay. So she sued him.
What came
out
of it?
She got $1,000 and she got his undying hatred. That's what came out of it. He hated it. He hated giving out money. Especially in that manner. Of course, I'd hate that, too. And that's when I started leaving the factory.
Were you embarrassed that your mother was suing on your behalf, or did you support her in the suit?
My mother is a very special person. I was used to her, you know, throwing a fit in a restaurant. This certainly didn't embarrass me. My mother could never be controlled.
So you started leaving the factory after this lawsuit?
Warhol definitely got cool towards me after the lawsuit, and I was not asked to do movies anymore. I noticed that when I hung around the set of the 24-hour movie, I wasn't really asked to be in. I mean, the people would ask me, but Warhol wasn't behind it that much, and so I left. Started doing plays for Ronnie Tavel.
You know, it's interesting to me that during this whole period when you were part of the Warhol crowd and, you know, you were performing with the Velvet Underground, Your home was with your parents. You were still living with you weren't there every night, maybe, but that was still your home.
That was my home, yes.
So, you know, you'd go from this incredibly out there kind of scene back to your parents' middle class nice home.
Yes, and lucky for me I did, otherwise I'd be dead. In other words, when you get high, you have to come down. When you go out, you have to come home. I had no money. I had to stay there.
Do you think this is part of the reason why you survived when so many of the Warhol people were casualties?
Absolutely. You can't get high without coming down. That's a myth.
So you really think you have your parents to thank in a way?
Oh, of course. My parents were great to me.
Do you think your mother did the right thing in not objecting to your behavior during that period?
Absolutely. If she had objected, first of all, you can't object. A child has to go through, and not just a child, everybody has to go through, it's like a journey that you take so that you can become, you know, someone else, so you can get, you know, your third eye or whatever. You can, you know, like, that's the American way, to go through something, a cathartic thing, so that in the end you gain stuff. And any kid knows that. They know they have to prove themselves. They, you know, they have to, I mean, kids used to want to go to war or whatever. Well, this was my war. Now, I met up with a stone wall because I went in with, you know, like, not a bad attitude, but just the wrong idea. I had to go through it again. But if she had stopped me, if she had stopped me and not let me do what I had to do, I would have gone harder, much harder.
Mm-hmm.
I would have left home, and that wouldn't be good.
What did you do with your life after leaving Warhol?
Well, for about a half a year, I just sat down and recovered.
Mm-hmm.
I had a tremendous addiction to get rid of.
And you got rid of it that quickly?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, in my family, you know, you just... my family is really strange. But, you know, you don't say anything. And the first thing I did was get very fat. And I just sat in my bedroom till that went away. It took about a couple of months. And then slowly but surely, I started being, you know, the next person. And went on a date. All the way to Europe. And, you know, you start again. But my parents, my parents are the 50s. You know, they never mentioned that you've done something wrong. When I came back and sat in my bedroom, you know, for about 2 months, they treated it as if, you know, everything was fine, which was, thank God, because I couldn't explain what was going on. All I know is I needed to rest.
Do you know who you are now, and are you comfortable with that person?
I am more comfortable with myself because I have gone through a lot of things. And, you know, once you go through these things, you go, yeah, well, you know, life isn't that bad. I still ask people what they think of me or who I am to them. So I don't know everything, no. And I do finally fulfilled because of this book. I know that I'm a good writer, and I'm really, really proud of myself for the first time.
Mary Woronov recorded in 1995. Her memoir, Swimming Underground, has just been published in paperback, and her debut novel, Snake, has just been published. An exhibit called Andy Warhol Social Observer opens June 17th at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia. Coming up, John Powers reviews Gone in 60 Seconds. This is Fresh Air. Gone in 60 Seconds is the new summer action movie starring Nicolas Cage and produced by Jerry Bruckheimer. It's also our last film review by John Powers, who's giving up reviewing films.
More and more, the movie in my head is not the movie that Hollywood is making. When I first heard about Gone in 60 Seconds, about car thieves who try to rip off 50 top-end cars in 24 hours, I thought of Steve McQueen, perhaps the last American screen actor who conveyed the sense that he would know how to hotwire a car or dismantle the club. I pictured a small, taut, gritty story about the expertise of an impassive, technique-minded man who's suddenly faced with losing everything, but who goes ahead because honor dictates that he has to get the job done. I'm still waiting to see that movie. The actual Gone in 60 Seconds is a loud, fragmented blockbuster of the new school, like the Indy 500 dropped into a Cuisinart. Nick Cage stars as Memphis Raines, a master car thief who's retired from the business. But when his brother, that's Giovanni Ribisi, gets in trouble with a gangster, Memphis agrees to save his brother's life by stealing those 50 cars. He quickly assembles his crew, which includes a savvy old-timer played by Robert Duvall, a silent brute known as the Sphinx, and his old girlfriend Sway, played with amusing swagger by Angelina Jolie, who looks like a cross between a ghost and a harpy. To make Memphis's task even more difficult, he's being tailed by his old nemesis, a police detective played by Delroy Lindo. Here, the two meet outside a bar.
6 years ago, you make a real smart move. You know, you retire from a lab that's gonna get you busted or killed, or maybe even both. And I'm thinking, I'm not putting you away when I had a chance. It's like this big fuck-up. This real impressive career that I've had.
Oh, yeah, well, without disappointment, you can't appreciate victory.
I don't know how to tell you that.
Well, now that's hidden below the belt.
Yeah, all right, let me tell you about below the belt, Randall. I tell you what, from here on out, if you walk across the street outside of a crosswalk, if you roll through a stop sign, if you use an aerosol can in a manner other than directed, I mean, I don't care. You make one slip and I will put you away for good.
As you can probably tell from this clip, Cage is giving yet another terrible performance. What happened to him? A friend jokingly suggested that Cage's Oscar for Best Actor contained some clause forcing him to become Sylvester Stallone. But frankly, Stallone would play Memphis with more conviction. Cage has lost the instincts that once made him a fascinating blend of the ardent and the offbeat. Now he's a hodgepodge of self-parodying mannerisms. Not that any actor could do much with Scott Rosenberg's script, which seems like a piece of lint that fell from Quentin Tarantino's navel. Rosenberg actually has somebody saying the line, "He will follow you like a stain on a mattress." Like a stain on a mattress? Such inept macho bluster is of a piece with Dominic Senna's direction, whose clumsiness is not disguised by the lickety-split music video style editing. There's an art to action, and Senna doesn't have it. None of his car chases is a tenth as exciting as those in, say, The Road Warrior or Ronin. Then again, the real auteur of Gone in 60 Seconds is producer Jerry Bruckheimer, who, along with his late partner Don Simpson, shaped current film style in movies like Flashdance, Top Gun, and Armageddon. I don't dislike all of his movies. In fact, I was a big fan of Enemy of the State. But I am out of sympathy with them. Bruckheimer's forever pushing his movies toward pure sensation. There's no depth of character, no coherence in storytelling, no real acting, and no awareness of meaning. Bruckheimer deals in clichés, some harmless enough, like the master car thief and the blonde who digs him. Others less appealing, like the saucy black dude who never takes off his shades, or the bad driver Asian chick who causes an accident and keens when her driving teacher criticizes her. This is the second Bruckheimer movie in a row that seeks cheap laughs by humiliating Asian women. You're the boss, Jerry, so cut it out. When I tell people that I'm giving up film reviewing, they usually wonder why I'd abandon such a cool job. The short answer is pictures like this one. I don't mean this moralistically, nor am I suggesting that movies in America are somehow going to hell. Pop culture is always changing, and I don't doubt that there are people out there who can discover fresh new ways of being excited by what's hitting our screens. For my part, I simply find little pleasure or nourishment in something like Gone in 60 Seconds. This is a movie about stealing cars that has no interest in stealing or cars. We don't learn how car thieves work, or how they live, or what they love about cars, or whether they're just in it for the money. We don't learn about hot wiring or diffusing alarm systems. We don't even get a scene where a car has to be gone in 60 seconds. Steve McQueen weeps.
John Powers has been Fresh Air's film critic for 4 years. I suspect no one is sorrier than we are that John is giving up film criticism. We'll miss his recommendations, and we'll miss his perceptions, wit, and general sensibility even more. Perhaps his leaving would be easier to take if his editor here, Phyllis Myers, found him egotistical and difficult to work with. Well, Phyllis, did you?
Nah, he was great.
So we wish him well, and we hope to hear from him from time to time on Fresh Air. And by the way, you'll be able to read his book reviews in Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schurach directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet, which will reunite for a concert at New York's Town Hall Sunday night. I'm Jerry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of 101 Ways by Mako Yoshikawa. From Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at saabusa.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. And from Random House Inc., Crown Division, publishers of The Forest, the novel by Edward Rutherford, author of London, and Sarum. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jim Kniffel talks about what he describes as the weirdness parade of his life. He's written two acclaimed memoirs that are very funny in spite of their subject matter, chronic depression, suicide attempts, and losing his eyesight. Sound like fun? I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.